BBC Radio
6 Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Nitin Sawhney.
If I were never to leave it, if I were always alone, if I were never to see you, if I could set with the sun.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time, the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week, I'm talking to an award-winning musician, composer, DJ and producer, one who combines worldwide influences with elements of jazz and electronica, exploring themes such as multiculturalism, politics and spirituality. He scored for and performed with countless orchestras and has collaborated with a mind-blowing array of luminaries, from Sir Paul McCartney to A.R. Rahman, from Brian Eno to Sinead O'Connor, from Nelson Mandela to Cirque du Soleil. He's also got an Ivor Novello Lifetime Achievement Award, 6 honorary doctorates and a CBE to his name. This week I'm delighted and honoured to say my guest on The First Time is Nitin Sawhney. Raised in Kent as a child, Nitin studied piano, classical and flamenco guitar, tabla and sitar. After dropping out of university, he trained as an accountant until he left his job to pursue a career in music. a good move. Moving to London, he met up with an old university friend, Sanjeev Bhaskar, and together they created the comedy team The Secret Asians, who secured a BBC radio show which eventually grew into the award-winning TV sketch series Goodness Gracious Me. And we started the show with Sunset from Nitin's 2001 album Prophecy, but his solo music career actually goes way back to 1993 when he released his debut, Spirit Dance. Now, to date, Nitin's released over 20 albums and scored around 60 films and TV programmes, alongside composing for theatre, dance and video games. In 1999, he released his gold-selling, Mercury-nominated album Beyond Skin, and on Friday, Nitin released his latest album, Immigrants, the official sequel. In this interview, recorded in 2019 and never aired before, Nitin recalls his earliest musical memories, playing in a Van Halen tribute band, and how he approaches writing film scores. Plus, we cover his love of Ennio Morricone, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, and Joni Mitchell. The first question we always ask everybody on the show is, when was the very first time they were aware of music as a kid? Can you remember that?
Yeah, I think it was when I was very young. I remember listening to my mum and dad's music. They would be playing on their record player, so I think I was aware of it from my brothers as well. So, you know, listening to Radio Caroline, listening to my mum and dad playing Indian classical music as well as flamenco and Cuban music, all kinds of things. I was just aware of sound and lovely sounds in the house, really.
Was it an important thing? Because in some households, music is just something you put on. And in other households, it's like, well, this is record time. Which one was it for you?
Yeah, I mean, it, depending what age we're talking about, I think it was, when I was about 4 or 5, I just loved all music. I just really enjoyed listening to anyone singing or playing or anything like that. And it was only when I was about 5 that I got really excited about the idea of being able to produce sound myself or music myself through a piano that we got from a local vicarage, from a friend of my mum's who just basically donated it to us from because they were going to get rid of it. So yeah, it was an old piano, and I just fell in love with it immediately.
Did you have that bond with this object in the household?
Oh, totally. I mean, I remember running up to it, and just like the first time I saw it, I literally just started banging on the keys and just, just feeling very happy. And also just all the frequency range, it just struck me as incredible that I could actually make this sound happen. I mean, you know, I'd been banned, I remember, because I remember riding a bike when I was very young, and I was banned from using my horn on the bike because I used to drive everyone nuts in the neighborhood. So I had to have some kind of cathartic outlet for sound when I was a kid. And apart from kind of screaming at the top of my voice, I think the piano was the next best thing.
Where is it now? Where's the piano and the horn?
Oh, well, the piano we've donated to a charity quite some time ago. The horn died a miserable death when I was about 5 or 6. I think people sacrificed it ritually, probably. But no, I have no idea what happened to that. But yeah, I mean, it was piano, definitely.
What about the first music that you went and you sought out that was, you know, this is, I'm going to go and find this from Woolworths or HMV, or, you know, I've got a record token for Christmas or whatever. That's different, isn't it? That's, I've chosen this.
It was Miles Davis, A Kind of Blue.
Really?
Yeah, when I was 8.
Get off.
No, it was because
that's
my
very good start.
I know, it was a great start. I had no idea it was, but I was already playing a bit of jazz, which I didn't know was jazz. I used to improvise a great deal. So I started playing piano from 5, and I played classical piano. But then I was just amazed by this sound, because we used to go up to see my uncle in London. I grew up in Rochester in Kent, and I remember, you know, when it was raining, and it was, I remember looking at the reflection of the traffic lights in, you know, in the road, and my dad had the radio on or something, and I remember them saying it was Miles Davis. My dad was a huge jazz fan as well, and I thought, I've got to get this. It's amazing sounds. And, you know, it was just, I just felt there was a beautiful mood. And I always loved how images and music work together. And I remember that particular image of the street and the actual red reflected in the road feeling like it married perfectly with the music I was listening to. I just didn't know anything about it. And I still feel that now. It's beautiful rainy night music.
Mm-hmm. Most musicians form an attachment to one instrument, maybe two, but that second one often supplements their understanding of their primary instrument. Even early on, that didn't make any sense to you, did it?
Well, I did have a really strong bond with the piano, and then when I was about eight, with the guitar.
Yeah.
And particularly flamenco guitar, I got into that quite young. I got into playing other instruments, but later, I mean, I was in love with the piano and the guitar, and then I got into playing later on a bit of tabla, and which is a beautiful Indian instrument, and percussion instrument, and then the sitar as well, at a nearby Gurdwara, which is a Sikh temple. I mean, I'm from a Hindi background, but we used to go and have lessons at a temple nearby, and that was amazing to have that opportunity, because I'd already grown up listening a lot to Panditji Ravi Shankar playing the sitar, and I loved his music, and so it was a real opportunity to find a way into that universe as well. So, you know, I was just lucky in that I'd already had a classical upbringing, so I understood that approach to music, and it was fantastic to have a whole other dimension in terms of getting a grip on Indian classical approaches as well.
Mentioned flamenco as being, it's always been a kind of thread that's run through. Paco de Lucia is a name that you've chosen, because I know so little about it. If I'm going out to buy a record in that world, what's the first thing that I should buy if I want an introduction into
flamenco? Of his?
Yeah.
Wow, I'm just trying to think of a great album. Ziryab, I really loved. One of my favourite tracks. Well, see, this is the thing, because you could access his music probably more easily through listening to something like Passion, Grace and Fire, with Saturday Night in San Francisco, I can't remember, or Friday night, I can't remember which night it was, but with John McLaughlin and Al Di Meola, and listening to how Paco de Lucia brought in very strong elements of jazz and other influences as well. I mean, he was a consummate musician in so many ways. This is a man who grew up practicing 12 hours a day when he was a child, and his father was very strict with him. In fact, I think he took him out of his school education at one point because he really wanted him to become a professional guitarist. And so, you know, his dedication to the guitar was phenomenal, but he was in love with the guitar. His older brother as well, Ramona, was a huge inspiration to him. You know, if you're into the guitar in any way, you will hear the power, the incredible emotion, the control. I mean, this is, for me, the greatest guitarist who ever lived. There is no one who can even touch him, to be honest. And I'd go right across every genre with no problem. I mean, I'd defy any guitarist who's living or dead to have even been able to get close to Paco de Lucia's technique and ability.
First concert that you went to that really made an impression on you, that maybe shifted that from I'm part of this, I'm appreciating this, I'm making this, to I want to share this? It's a very different mindset.
Wow. I mean, there's so many concerts that I went to when I was a kid that I loved. So I was kind of into all kinds of music. I mean, I was into heavy rock as well at one point. I went through all kinds of stages of being into punk and heavy rock as well as...
I think a heavy rock phase is good for any teenager. I think
absolutely.
You just have to have that rhythmical grounding in there somewhere. If you don't like a little bit of Maiden or Sabbath, you need it.
Totally. Well, this is the thing. It's interesting because that whole thing with Iron Maiden and all those, you know, the new wave. Do you remember Jeff Barton and the new wave of
British metal?
Yeah, exactly, and all of that. And I remember around that time, I don't know what age I would have been, but you know, bands like I remember going to the Radio Caroline Roadshow and seeing Angel Witch and bands like that, which is quite mad. I learned to play Eruption from Van Halen, and I was in the Van Halen covers band. I did all kinds of things. So as well as jazz, I played with a jazz quartet, and I played with youth orchestras when I was a kid. But it was nice to be able to kind of jump into other things. And so, yeah, I suppose, you know, in terms of concerts, there were heavy rock concerts, but there's also... I remember seeing the Crusaders when I was young, and Wilton Fowler, incredible sax player, and listening to him and Joe Sample, I think, on Rhodes piano. So I was kind of really in love with what they were doing. I play the street light because there's no place I can go. Street light, it's the only life I know. Street light, and there's a thousand parts to play. Street life, until you play your life away. You let the people see just who you wanna be. And every night you shine just like a superstar. That's how the life is played, a tempting masquerade. You dress, you walk, you talk, you're who you think you are. Street life, you can run away from time. Street life, for a nickel or a dime. Street life, but you better not get old. Again, as a teenager, I saw Mahavishnu Orchestra and John McLaughlin. I was a real muso when I was a teenager, and it took me a long time to grow out of that, actually, because I was always motivated by how skillful people were and how impressive they were. Although I also would listen to a whole range of different singers who touched me emotionally. But it was, you know, if I was looking for instrumentalists, I'd always be thinking about their technique, and including people like Billy Cobham on drums. That was my way of enjoying music, I guess.
It's a well-worn phrase, but I think it's quite true. It's the Picasso quote, when, because he could draw like Michelangelo when he was like 11, and he was like, yeah, it's taking him a whole life to unlearn that. You need the tools, and then you need how to, then you have to understand how to throw the tools aside.
Absolutely. I mean, Picasso, he could draw in virtually any style, and this was the thing about him, is that he had a whole range of influences, but then he found his own voice. And I think that's really important for me. You know, I love the idea of kind of experimenting with so many different ways of thinking. That works really well. I'm a full-on film composer, I guess, now. And so that's very handy. I mean, with some films, I've been asked to write something spontaneously in the style of Burt Bacharach or something, you know, or a jazz piece or a full-on rock piece, as well as orchestrating and writing for orchestras. So, you know, you never know what you can get hit with. And so as a film composer, it's really handy to have a whole range of styles you've been into.
What was the first film you scored?
It was a film called Flight, which was for the BBC. I think that's back in about 93, 94. It was actually a film about an Asian women's refuge. Alex Pillay was the director. And I think, from what I recall, I think Mira Sial might have been in it, and Mina Anwar. Yeah, and Ravi Kapoor. Yeah, and it was a nice film.
As we're on the subject of films, we should come to another name on your list, Ennio Morricone.
Yeah.
When did you first fall in love with his work?
Well, it was around the same time I fell in love with Bernard Herrmann's work for Hitchcock. And it was, again, going up to my uncle's house in London. I remember being in a room where, you know, my uncle would be watching TV, or black and white TV, and watching films like Psycho and so on. And then later on, I remember seeing... So I was pretty young, but I saw... I think it was A Fistful of Dollars when I was about 8 or 9, something like that. And I shouldn't have probably been watching it, I don't know. But it was a great film. I loved the film itself. And I was like, wow, Clint Eastwood's so cool. But then also the music blew my mind. I just thought, how is that? I mean, the marriage of the music and the images was just astonishing to me. And, you know, Ennio Morricone's best known for those spaghetti westerns, but also he's so consistent with everything from The Untouchables to the Mission to The Hateful Eight most recently. I mean, you know, he's a man who's got magical touch with his understanding of not only composition but orchestration. I mean, he always said that a great composer should orchestrate their own work, and that's something I've really taken on board. I really like to orchestrate my own work. Sometimes I'll work with another orchestrator, but I'll always at least have a very strong hand in orchestrating what I do. And I think that's because that's your sound. It's very difficult to let go of your sound to another person. A lot of film composers do get orchestrators in who will orchestrate everything. I can't really do that.
Another first, 1993, first solo album, the first.
Yeah, so around the same time as, and it was nice because my film composing career kind of literally has run in parallel to my album career.
So Spirit Dance, yeah. I mean, so that record, what can you remember about it? There's different disciplines there, aren't there?
Yeah, very much. It's kind of a bit of an ego trip if you're making an album. You know, you're the dictator in the studio. You decide what's going to happen. Whereas actually, if you're working with a director, you're helping to realise their vision. And so, you're listening to them, and it's as much about their psychology as it is about the psychology of the characters and the narrative. You know, it's a very close collaborative relationship that you have with the director. Of course, you know, with Ennio Morricone, it was with Sergio Leone. Ennio Morricone was one of those people who just always talked about the importance of orchestration and finding a sound that worked well with the director's vision. You know, for me, I've been lucky to work with several directors I've really admired, and most recently, I guess, with people like Andy Serkis, with Breathe and Mowgli. Every time you work with a director, it's a real experience.
Let's do another first. Joni Mitchell, if you're talking about someone, a guitarist that has found her own sound and found her own way of playing the instrument, what was the first record of hers that you really fell in love with?
It's interesting you should say that before I say, you know, is because she actually started off as a ukulele player.
Is that where the strange...
Yeah, the tunings, because she has unusual tunings. And her, I think it was her mother who didn't want her to be like a hillbilly guitarist. That's what she said to her, because, you know, she was getting into country music, and she kind of was worried that she would get into that kind of style, so she ended up playing apparently the ukulele. I think she's a great musician as well as fantastic singer. Blue was, of course, the album that literally blew my mind, and I thought it was so beautiful. I mean, all of the tracks are so emotional. I learned later on that her daughter, she'd actually had adopted. I think she was 21 or whatever when she became pregnant, and she said, I think, that she became a songwriter in her own mind from that moment onwards, and that she was always trying to express feelings that she would want to express to her daughter. Although Blue is actually nothing to do with that, in terms of it's more about her journeys and travels, and a lot of the tracks are very emotional and beautifully written in terms of their lyrics as well as the music and the melodies. But one of the most incredible albums of all time, I think it was it came 30th in the, I don't know what chart it was, but the best albums of all time.
You should hear Before You Die, that list of records.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, incredible.
Look out the left, the captain said, the light's down there, that's where we'll land. I saw a falling star burn up above the Las Vegas sands. It wasn't the one that you gave to me that night down south between the trailers. Not the early one that you can wish upon, not the northern one that guides in the sailors. Oh, star bright, you've got the loving that I like, all right. Turn this crazy bird around, I shouldn't have gone this flight tonight. You got the touch so gentle and sweet, but you got that look so critical. Now I can't talk to you, baby, I get so weak. Sometimes I think love is just musical. Up there's the heavens, down there's the town. Blackness everywhere and little lights shine. Oh, darkness, blackness, dragging me down. Come on, light the candle in this poor heart of mine. I like, all right. Turn this crazy bird around. I shouldn't have got on this flight tonight. I'm drinking sweet champagne, got the headphones up high. Can't numb you out, can't drum you out of my mind. They're playing down go the wheels. I hope you got your heat turned on, baby. I hope they finally fixed your automobile. Hope it's better when we meet again, baby. Star bright, you got the love that I like. All right, turn this crazy bird around. Shouldn't have gone
That was This Flight Tonight by Joni Mitchell, the choice of my guest on the first time this week, Nitin Sawhney. And we'll have more from my chat with Nitin after the Six Music News.
Six Music.
This is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. I'm Claire Runacres. Senior politicians from across the parties are urging against booking summer holidays abroad at the moment. Labour says caution is needed so the good work done by the vaccine drive isn't unravelled. The Defence Secretary Ben Wallace has said the UK doesn't want to import new COVID variants and people should wait for the results of a government task force looking at vaccine passports and travel next month. Ben Wallace has also warned that any attempt by the European Union to block vaccine exports would be counterproductive. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has said it could halt exports amid frustrations that the EU is not getting the supplies it wants. Mr. Wallace told the Andrew Marr Show that making the vaccine was a collaborative approach and the European Commission should honour legal contracts signed with pharmaceutical companies.
The grown-up thing would be for the European Commission and some of the European leaders to not indulge in rhetoric, but to recognise the obligations that we all have, pull together, where can we maximise supply and help roll out that supply.
A snapshot of life in England, Wales and Northern Ireland is being captured today as people take part in the latest census. It's a legal requirement for each household to complete a form, answering questions about issues such as age, race, occupation and relationship status. Stian Westlake is from the Royal Statistical Society.
The census provides just absolutely invaluable information to help plan how many GP surgeries we need, how many schools we need, hospital coverage. And it's also used by businesses if you're planning a new supermarket or if you're planning a new leisure centre. All of these things rely on the census data to tell us where people live, how old they are and where they are.
And an Arctic walrus spotted on rocks off the southern Irish coast last week has now been seen off Pembrokeshire. The RSPCA says the young walrus appears to be in good condition. A spokeswoman says there have been many calls about animals over the years, but it's probably the first time any have been about a walrus. That's Six Music News. Your next update's at 2:30.
This is BBC Radio 6
Music.
Now on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 6
Music.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time with my guest, composer, musician and DJ, Nitin Sawhney, an interview which was recorded in 2019 but has never been broadcast until now. And you've just heard Homelands from Nitin's breakthrough album, Beyond Skin, released in 1999. I was thinking about this on the way to the interview, this idea of blending different musics and taking elements of jazz and elements of soul and elements of classical, Indian classical and European classical and all this kind of thing, and how you blend them together. I don't know why more people don't try and do it. Is part of it fear? Is part of it you need a certain amount of adeptness and understanding? Because we're comfortable with people blending genres, but very few people do it successfully. Very few people even attempt it. And I just struck me as being, why didn't your success prompt a whole generation of people trying to do a similar thing, as it would do with, I don't know, heavy metal becoming popular or, you know?
Well, thank you for what you've just said. It's interesting because I think it's the default position.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like to absorb and interpret. And
I think a lot more young people are becoming increasingly open to different ways of thinking about music from across the world. Probably YouTube has helped with that, and you know, online understanding. And you know, if it, when I was a kid, it was, you had to go and find a teacher, and you had to really seek music out that you were interested in. Whereas now, yeah, you can just have it at your fingertips, literally on a computer, and you can get even tuition in any style. And I think that's very exciting. And so you see some real virtuoso musicians coming up these days. But having said that, I do feel surprised that that more people aren't embracing an eclectic way of thinking about musical expression. And I think the wider your palette, the more interesting the possibilities of your emotional painting, I suppose, sonically. And I guess that's something I feel very happy with, that I've had that kind of background in terms of looking at so many different styles of music, and I still continue to look that way and try and find challenging new music across the world.
Let's pick another name from your list. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, another huge figure in the world of music. What was it about? Was it just the voice? Did that speak to you? Was it the whole world created around this sort of almost godlike figure?
Qawwali is such a powerful form, which Ustad Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan was the greatest exponent of, in many people's opinion, including mine. He was somebody who also transcended his form, in that he was an inspiration to people like Jeff Buckley, who called him his Elvis. You also have, you know, an incredible track record with his voice being used in films like Dead Man Walking, Last Temptation of Christ, Natural Born Killers, Bandit Queen, so many films that his voice worked well in. But I think that's because his voice had a universal emotional power to it, that I think you know, there are no other voices that I think have that transcendent quality that his did. Died, I think, 22 years ago, in 97. But I remember on the day that he died, I was due to speak to him because I was doing a remix for him for an album called Star Eyes for Real World. And so it was incredibly weird that I found out. I was literally supposed, for the first time, I'd never spoken to him or met him. And so I was due to talk to him that morning, and then I was told he'd passed away. You know, it was very, very powerful emotionally. And so I made that track a tribute to him, based on an old Sufi poem, Sufism being the form of, well, a kind of religious form that he was part of. I heard him many times over the years. I mean, originally when he was signed to Oriental Star, but later on with Real World, and then, you know, Michael Brook, the incredible Must album, which that main track, title track, was remixed by Massive Attack in 1990, and beautifully done. And of course, I was hugely into Massive Attack as well, and love what they did. So it was the perfect blend to me. I'd heard people like Bali Sagu, you know, there were a lot of Asian artists who'd also had a go at remixing his work. He was part of the fabric of Asian consciousness in this country at the time, but I think he really blossomed in my ears with the Must album with Michael Brook, and particularly with Massive Attack's remix.
I would like to ask you about the OBE. There are certain things that, like, when you do these interviews, that kind of loom around, and some of them are sort of quasi-mythical, and some of them turn out to be very different to what you read. it seemed like a really, I don't know what the best way of describing it, a really ballsy move to turn it down, if the legend is true, for reasons of, very powerful reasons, as a protest to colonialism. And then when the slightly upscale honour offer comes back, go, yeah, okay, that's more like it.
No, it wasn't like that. I mean, yeah, that, but that was...
It's a lovely image of, like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was purely a negotiation position.
No.
I mean, it
ring
was...
Ring the big guns and then we can talk.
It wasn't, no. So the way it worked was... no, originally when I did turn it down, I think it was 2005 or something like that, the OBE, it was the war in Iraq, and it was also, which I hugely disagreed with and still do, but also I had an issue with the word empire after my name. I didn't really want that, and I didn't really feel like I could identify with that colonial history. You're absolutely right. What happened was that my dad, he said to me after I turned it down, he said, look, you know, it would have been great for my birthday if you'd taken it, and the reason is we've, you know, it would have been testimony to how far we've come, you know, coming over here as immigrants, and the idea that my son could get an OBE would be incredible for me. And I went, okay, but I still feel happy that I did turn it down. And then last year, on my dad's birthday, and he passed away in 2013, I got a letter saying, would you take a CBE? And it was on my dad's birthday, and I went, okay.
What are you going to do? I mean, come on.
You know, it was, and I'd always kind of felt, you know, he'd gone to his grave with regret, and he was sad that I didn't take it. And so I took it, and weirdly, then they told me that the day that I was to receive it was actually my mum and dad's wedding anniversary, which just so happened to be. So I kind of, I mean, you know, signs, whatever, but... It felt like it was okay to take it somehow. But yeah, I still have the same objections to word. I mean, I don't readily, you know, it's not my Twitter or my Instagram or anything. But, and also it did occur to me that somebody does want to acknowledge the work that I've done, and that's very kind of them. And, you know, I didn't want to appear ungrateful either, you know, a second time. So, yeah, I mean, I appreciate it. I still have the same objection to the word empire. I think there's quite a lot of people who have recently, you know, protested about that. If, for example, in France, you have the title is Knight of Arts and Letters, which I think is a great title. I suppose it's a strange one. I did feel in two minds about it, but having taken it, I don't regret it at all.
I always like it when musicians get those honours, because it always feels like someone sort of snuck under the fence a little bit.
Yeah, I definitely feel that way. Also, it's quite weird because there's part of me that kind of doesn't feel, I feel like an imposter, like a lot of people probably do. But I mean, so it's kind of, it's affirmation in a way. I mean, I go to therapy, and so sometimes that's one of my issues, is that I don't feel like I deserve things at times. So I suppose it's a tangible thing that I could say, well, I got that, I guess. But so I don't know.
Anyone that believes they deserve things, it's like people that have got no lack of confidence. Those tend to be the sociopathic people anyway, and we don't want them.
We've got a lot of them around.
if you're not looking over your shoulder going, am I going to be found out here?
Yeah.
Then I think you belong on Wall Street.
Yeah, I agree.
Which kind of brings us, in a strange kind of way, there's a political element to what we were just talking about. Your first oratorio is Brexit, a rationale anthem for a national tantrum. It's a very difficult thing for musicians to talk about politics, because your viewpoint is different to so many other people. How did you negotiate that?
I don't find it hard to talk about my views on the world. It's very difficult to be passive in a world that has become so politicized in such a negative way. So, for example, I do feel that I have an obligation to speak out against injustice as a human being. And so as a musician, it's an extension of that. And music that I make, I always try to make it honest and about who I am and come from my identity. So I always made albums that were expressing my relationship with the world around me, whether it was migration or which was one of my albums, and Displacing the Priest, which was my views on religion, or whether it was Beyond Skin, which is about identity related to nationality and religion, and then Prophecy, which was about my trip around the world. I'm always looking at ways of expressing my relationship with the world. So I don't find that difficult to navigate. But with Brexit, it was a commission from Sky Arts, and we performed it to sold out crowd at the Barbican, which was fun. I did it with the London Contemporary Voices and also with National Youth Orchestra, which was a real privilege to work with both of them, and also with members of my band. So yeah, I really enjoyed doing it. I did it in three movements. The lyrics are very much from my perspective. I mean, it was a weird one because they asked me to write a national anthem. And I thought, well, you know, you can't really ignore Brexit. So it just came out the way it did. And it's kind of a satirical dig at the whole thing, I guess. It was an opportunity to try to get into some classical writing as well. So I wrote it by hand on a tablet. There's some software that allowed me to write by hand, which then could be turned into print. And I really enjoyed doing that. So I could write on the train, I could write on the plane. So it was really handy doing that. And so that's the way I wrote it, which made me feel very connected with it. It was the first time I'd done that with orchestral work and choral work. So I really enjoyed that process, and it was great to see them perform it and for it to sound exactly as it had sounded in my mind as well.
And it's Bjørnskjæg's 20th anniversary.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's very exciting. It's interesting in that the themes and the ideas of Bjørnskjæg feel more pertinent now than they felt in 1999 in many ways. And people's response to us performing Bjørnskjæg, the album, live has been phenomenal. Again, I'm working with String Quintet and bringing in London Contemporary Voices to work with me and some brilliant musicians who I've worked with for many years. So I feel very fortunate that I'll get the chance to do that.
Sometimes doing research for these interviews is difficult. Doing research for you is very easy because there's a lot out there, and you're like omni-knit-knit. It's everywhere. This desire to keep working, this desire to not stop, not have a fallow period or not disappear, this idea to keep seeking out, being that working with choreographers or being that working with films or TV or solo stuff, where does that restlessness come from, that desire to not ever stop?
It's interesting because I think it used to come from running away from myself, running away from my own feelings, running away from dealing with feelings of inadequacy and just being insecure as a human being. I think now I make music to feel more connection with myself, and I think that's probably been the journey that I've kind of gone through over time. And I feel it's interesting, you know, performing an album that I first wrote 20 years ago, because it's a totally different way that I'll look at it. And I think, you know, that's something I feel good about. And it's the first time, I think, over the last year or two that I've started to really feel good about my life, accepting of the idea that I can have a work-life balance as well. So that's something, you know, I genuinely feel has been a good positive outcome of musical expression and what music's given me.
And the final thing is we ask everyone to pick the last song to play. What should we go out on?
I love Riverside by Agnes Obel. I think she's an incredible artist. She grew up playing classical music. She's from Denmark, born in Copenhagen. Yeah, superb artist. You know, a lot of her music sounds cinematic. In fact, I think Riverside was used in Grey's Anatomy. She's one of those people who really can capture a mood and emotion with her voice, just the tone of her voice, let alone the instrumentation. you know, for me, somebody whose minimalistic sound and approach to music really works so beautifully. And having seen her live as well, she's a consummate musician who's really in touch with an ability to be able to express something that comes from her soul. It sounds like that to me anyway.
Then that's what we'll finish on. It's been very good to speak to you. Thank you.
Same to you. Thank you, Matt.
That was Agnes Obel and her stunning track Riverside, the final choice of my guest here on The First Time this week, Nitin Sawhney. You can search for The First Time in the BBC Sounds app to find more episodes from the archive and recent shows, such as my chat last week with Laurie Anderson. Loyal Carne is up next. I'll be back next Sunday talking to Laura Marlin, one of the headliners of this year's Six Music Festival. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
It's BBC Radio.
Six Music. Right now, it's Loyal Carner.